Hello, and welcome to what is the first podcast from me here. Just to give a quick introduction, there's two reasons this podcast has been made. The first is that it's been recorded to be released on the 29th of April, 2010, which for those following the ride is the second anniversary of when I left home. So it's a little celebration for that, primarily because I'm too lazy to write a proper blog or make any real features for the website, and I found if I just get someone to interview me, making a podcast is a lot easier. And the second reason is that having been so long on the road, it's come to my attention that I need something to keep my brain busy. So this is the first of what's going to be a series of podcasts that will be released over the coming months. The interviews are already well underway, so don't worry. The future shows are going to feature a lot less of my voice, and it looks like there's going to be a series of shows covering quite a wide variety of subjects about life on the bicycle. The shows I'm looking to make are going to cover quite basic themes, such as how to plan an adventure, the different routes available, where can you go, what sort of bicycle do you want, and what equipment do you need. But also a few more diverse topics, such as what to do when things go wrong and the dangers of cycle touring. A show about love on the road and the strains a bike tour can have on a relationship, and even a show about the different sorts of people you meet through the various hospitality networks and the kind of people who are happy to take a stranger into their home. As I say, the interview's already well underway, and I have to say they've gone very well so far. But if anyone out there is listening to this and think they've got a story which other people would be interested to hear, remember, it doesn't necessarily have to be about bike touring, but please keep it generally towards the themes, then please get in contact with me. My email address is on the website, worldwidebikeride.com, where you've downloaded this podcast from, and please don't be shy. In the meantime, here's the first podcast, which is an interview between myself and Tom Gibbon, a journalist from the Banbury Guardian back home in England. And it's to celebrate the fact that how I've now successfully spent the last 2 years of my life on a bicycle. Pick up the interview right at the beginning.
Good stuff. Tell us broadly about the route so far. Obviously, there's a lot of it to talk about, but where have you been?
Okay, yep, the quickest way to run this down is I left England, left home in Chaikum, 29th of April 2008, headed through Europe to Istanbul, went along the Black Sea coast into Georgia, Azerbaijan, got a boat from there to Kazakhstan, was in Kyrgyzstan, crossed China, Southeast Asia, Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam, back to China. From there, across China again, another about 2,000, 3,000 miles, I think, into Korea, got a boat from there to Korea, boat to Japan, from Tokyo, flew over to America, went up to Alaska, up to Prudhoe Bay, right at the top of the Arctic Ocean, and since August, have been cycling back down through Canada, down the west coast of the States, into Mexico, into where I am now in Veracruz. It's been about 37,500 kilometers, or just shy of 25,000 miles.
Blimey, not bad going. Your initial plan, if I remember rightly, was to get as far as kind of Vietnam and come back, more or less. What changed? What made you sort of think again and carry on?
When I left my home in Chaikum, I'd never really ridden a bike for more than a day at a time, and I didn't know, like, if I would enjoy it, how well I'd get on with it. I'd always had the dream, like, I hadn't really told anyone, I'd always had the dream of cycling around the world. But, like, I'd never really ridden the bike, I wasn't sure how much I'd enjoy it, how well I'd settle into the lifestyle. And then after about 3 weeks, I knew that I wasn't going home until I really had no choice but to go home. So
yeah.
I've had a look at the finances, I can just about afford it. So I've been quite lucky, managed to work a couple of times on the road to get some more money together. So the plan's never really just to go to Vietnam. That's just what I told people in case I failed. So that way it wasn't such a big failure as getting to Germany and coming home.
Excellent stuff. So, what have been the highlights? What's your, what are your sort of favourite countries and why? And indeed, the flip side, what's been the lowlights?
The highlights is always hard to just nail down one or two over like the 2 years. In terms of favourite countries, the answer I have for this question, because it's always one asks, is I've got a favourite place that I'd love to live and a favourite place that I'd love to go back and ride again. I'd start with a favourite place to go back and or recommend anyone to go and ride a bike is Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia. I had the best month there possible. It's beautiful, big mountains, wonderful scenery, wonderful people, and could really not recommend anywhere higher than Kyrgyzstan to go and ride a bike. And as to live, I'd love to go and live in Korea. I've never been anywhere where it's so clean, such beautiful scenery. The people are so friendly. No crime. I remember being in a bar in Seoul, in the capital city, and was with a couple of people I was staying with out there, and they put their mobile phones down on the table and just in the middle of the night, nightclub, just leave their money lying around, walk off, go to the bathroom, come back, and they knew everything would be there. So I just found
good world.
Yeah, I just found that to me was one of the strangest, most pleasant experiences I've had.
Excellent stuff. How much of it has been civilized. I've sort of, the pictures I've seen of you have all been on, well, more or less all been on sort of barren desert roads and things. I mean, how close have you been at any one time to, like I say, sort of civilized, what we'd think of as Western society?
I mean, that's a strange question. It's a good question. I've never been that far away from society. I mean, like, I think the most rural part I've been to was, I did 9 days from Fairbanks to Prudhoe Bay in Alaska. I cycled the road backwards. Prudhoe Bay is the right at the top of the Arctic Ocean up there. And I think there was maybe 3 stops where you could buy some, like, chocolate or, like, a plate of chips in between. But even then, it was still ridiculously extortionate, so I didn't bother. And then the last 4 days, you didn't see anyone from... You didn't see, like, there was no shop, anything like that. You saw people driving past. So, but the 4 days from, I think it's a little village, a work camp called Coldfoot, up to Prudhoe Bay, was 240 miles of gravel road, no one around, just in the wilderness. But I can carry 10 days food at a time. Yeah. So that's not so much of a problem.
Did that scare you at all, knowing that you were absolutely sort of nowhere near anywhere?
No, I think that's the one thing that people often get mistaken about on the bike, is like that it's dangerous to be off, or like if something happens to the bike, you're then stranded in the middle of nowhere. Is wherever you are on the bike, the one thing that you always have with you is a road. So that what's on every road is there's cars. So even if something does go wrong with the bike, you're always going to have someone drive past you at some point, no matter where you are. So even if the worst does happen, you can always get picked straight back up and hitchhike to the next town and what have you.
Back someone down, good stuff. We spoke about your highlights just a minute ago. What about the places you wouldn't go back to? What's been the more regrettable, like, if you like, experiences?
I wouldn't say regrettable in places that I've been to that I didn't like, because I still think you should go to places that you don't like.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you just, if you hear someone says, "Oh, I don't like it there," I've heard places, been to places where people said, "Oh, I didn't like it there," and then I had a great time. But there's certainly places I wouldn't go back to. I wouldn't go back to Vietnam. Really didn't enjoy it there. China, wouldn't go back to there either. Eastern China, the different reasons are, Eastern China for a start was just so overcrowded. It wasn't much fun. No disrespect to the Chinese, but their driving isn't really fantastic.
Yeah.
So I got hit by a car out there, but that was just like, that was a let off really. I've had quite a few near misses, and every city came across. I was in China again for 2 months the second time round, and I passed through about 6 or 7 different cities that were over 7 million people. So I quite like the peace and quiet, but didn't really enjoy
absolutely.
That. As for Vietnam, the main reason I wouldn't go back to Vietnam is I just got fed up of being ripped off for everything. When you go to the poorer, like the less economically developed countries, you do try and you expect to pay a little bit extra, and you kind of have to just grin and bear that. But in Vietnam, I found I was being charged like 4 or 5 times the price for things, and you were sort of made to feel like an outsider. Everywhere else, I've been made to feel welcome, and people take you into their homes and really want you to interact with you. In Vietnam, they were just people who trained their kids to ask me for money and just didn't enjoy it. Being seen as a wallet.
Talking about being ripped off, how are your finances? How are you sort of affording to do this? And what's your budget?
I'm trying to live off £3 a day when I'm on the road. I can get by pretty easily off £3 a day. Breakfast is usually a loaf of bread and jam. Lunch is usually a loaf of bread and jam. Both have a cup of coffee with them, and then for dinner I've got rice with fried veg. So when you're on the road, it's really easy to live off £3 a day. But in general, and the other things are there's the hidden costs that add up, such as replacement bike parts. You have to have splash on the odd bit of clothes. You won't always want to have a nice meal sometimes. Sometimes you just have to treat yourself. When I left England, I had £7,000 saved up. I've got about £1,500 left of that, and I've managed to sort out probably another £3,000 for the next 2 years. So I've got enough money. That means I've lived off £5,500 for the first 2 years. But I think quite a lot of that went in the first 6 months when I was learning how to live to the budget, how to
spend. How much has sort of hospitality helped you out? I mean, there's been quite a few nights where you've just been taken in by random families and things.
Every country I've been to, I've been taken in. So there's not a country I've been to where someone hasn't met me in the street and taken me into their home and let me stay the night.
And then, that's fantastic. You kind of expected that, I suppose. That must be really...
It's really nice, yeah.
For one of the better words.
Yeah, it's really nice. I mean, like, in a lot of countries, particularly in, like, I've been in Mexico for the last month, and I've been invited in everywhere I've been. I've never been anywhere. It's like, it's seen as the culture is you have to have somewhere to stay. It's not... They can't just let you walk past without giving you anything. So I find that pretty humbling. Like, I often wonder if it would be like that in England. I think you do get taken in England, and we've taken in people in England that you've met on the street, and cyclists and people like that, but I don't think it would be as common as it has been in other parts. And it's always like it's always the people that have the least money are the most happy to take you in as well. It's one of the great things. It's always the people that don't have the big houses, much money, they're the people that are most happy to take you in, give you a free meal.
Yeah. Excellent. Are you missing home? How do you sort of deal with home sickness if you get it at all?
Well, yeah, I think this is the question where I'm supposed to say that I miss my family and friends, but as harsh as this sounds, you've got Skype and you've got email, so they're never that far away. I mean, my mum and dad came out for 2 weeks last December, and it was good to see them.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I have to be honest, I don't really miss Banbury. I've never really had the desire, like I've been really down and wanted to quit riding the bike, I've never had the desire to get on a plane home, of all places. So it's the hardest thing I found is I really missed like English food. Is that it? You can't get a proper pie and chips anywhere out here. Fish and chips. I miss Saveloys is one of the things that you just can't get anywhere else in the world. So that's the thing I've been missing home. And the one way that I found like is to cope with it. If you are missing home, if you've been out, the times that you're like missing home, you're missing food, you're missing like just basically English lifestyle, is McDonald's is everywhere in the world. And when you're missing home, you can go to McDonald's, and it's good to go into McDonald's, because then you go into McDonald's, eat some of their crappy food, and you just remember that being back in England isn't all it's cracked up to be.
What's the funniest thing? What's the strangest thing you've eaten in these past 2 years?
This was probably a couple of weeks ago, actually. I was staying out on the farm, as I was saying, in the countryside with his family, and we came back for lunch one day. I'd been helping their son with his homework, with his English homework, and we came back for lunch, and the two men of the family had been out hunting iguanas, and they'd been out with like a pellet gun. They'd shot some iguanas, and then they fried up the iguanas for us.
And how was that?
It wasn't good, I'll be honest, it didn't. I wouldn't be in a rush to eat it again.
Dear, that sounds interesting.
Apart from that, horse, I've probably eaten dog at some point, but I couldn't tell you about it. I think we had a bit of crocodile meat in China, but yeah, I think the iguanas, especially as they're just literally skinned and fried and you can still make out the body shape, is pretty much the most disgusting thing I've had.
You spoke earlier, Kyrgyzstan, I think you said, was the best place you've been in terms of place to ride. How about the hardest? What have you found the toughest place?
There's three things that I've found when I've been riding that have been really, really, really tough. The first time was in Kazakhstan. I was in the desert for a week, and being the genius and unplanned that I am, I showed up it was beginning of August, so the hottest time of year, showed up in the desert, and it was getting 45, maybe 50 degrees at the hottest each day, and into a headwind on an unpaved road really wasn't much fun. So that was tough, being around there like every day when you want water. I was getting through about 13, 14 litres of water a day, and every time I ran out of water, I'd have to stand by the side of the road with my bottle and just hope a truck would stop and give me some water. So that was tough. But it was doable. The next toughest one is, I quite like the story, I was in Kyrgyzstan. Strangely enough, like, favourite place to ride was also one of the toughest ones. But there's a road, I think it was about 100 miles. But it started out, it was unpaved, it wasn't even a gravel road. It was just horrible to ride on. I spent 3 days travelling at about an average of 6 miles an hour, going up hills at about 3 miles an hour. But it wasn't just that. You'd start at 1,000 metres elevation, and then you'd climb up to about 3,500 metres. I think you came back down and up again twice on that trip on some of the worst roads imaginable. And worst of all, I ran out of food. There was two villages on my map, and neither of them existed. So I ran out of food halfway through. So I spent 3 days on this really tough road, down to the emergency supplies, But the whole time I was, I was just the whole time thinking, I want to go home. This isn't fun. I'm struggling here. But the whole time I could see another bike track in front of me, or I could see two tire marks on the road in front of me.
Yeah.
So the whole time I was thinking, there's someone not too far in front of me. And I'm thinking, who else is going to be out here? So I got to the next town, and just as I was coming in, I saw the two cyclists who it was, and they were two 71-year-olds from Germany who had just been doing the same thing. So 50 years older than me, but still out there on one of the toughest roads that I've been on.
Ah, oh, that's incredible. Have you come across many other cyclists on similar sort of epic adventures as yours?
I've come across hundreds of people who are off cycle touring. I've probably met about 20 or... probably about... 20 might be an exaggeration, but I've either met or know people who are on round the world rides right now and who are out there. So there are plenty and plenty of other cyclists. In Central Asia, as I say, it's one of the nicest places, like a really famous place to ride a bike. So every day you'd meet two or three other cyclists. And in Southeast Asia as well, you'd meet lots of other people who are out there for a month, 6 weeks, just having a cycle round.
Have you found it's like a bit of a kind of community spirit among fellow riders?
Yeah.
Taken in and looked after.
Yeah. That's the thing is, once you meet another cyclist, you'll stay with that person as well. Is the general rule. You'll stay with that person until you go your separate way. So it's always nice to ride with other people, and especially the people who are on the long haul rides. There's just an understanding that when you meet people, you both want some company. So you'll just spend a couple of weeks with them. I quite like this story. I was in. I bumped into two. I met one couple. They were a couple from Germany or Austria, or one of them was from Germany and one of them was from Austria. And I met them in China, far western China, in Xinjiang, where the riots were last year. I met them there, and then I was in Canada coming along in the street, and I bumped into them again. We were headed in different directions at this point, but just after 6 months, I think it was about 6-7 months since we'd last seen each other, just bumped into them again in the street, as you do. So it's always nice to just bump into street. And the other person was, I was up in northern Canada. I was met a Japanese guy and was riding with him for about 10 days. And we got on really well. He'd been cycling for about 4 years. He'd been all over the world. He'd been Africa, Asia, everywhere.
Yeah.
I was riding with him for 10 days. And then I got down into Mexico and sent him an email. Or no, I found an email from him saying, like, hi, I'm here down in Mexico. I haven't spoken to you for a while. How's it going? Where are you? And it turns out he was sat about 200 meters away from me. We were just in the next internet cafe down, so was there
it
with
is a
him
small
for,
world after all.
Yeah, so I was there with him for another week.
What's been your biggest challenge?
Biggest challenge is keeping yourself sane a lot of the time. Is a lot of the time you are on your own, you're sat there talking to yourself. So books. I lost my iPod in, I think it would have been April last year. When I say I lost it, it just stopped working. I didn't lose it, but like I lost it as in it died.
Yeah.
So living without music for a couple of months, and then going from lots of technology to no technology is quite difficult right at the start, but you get used to it. It's quite a liberating feeling losing your mobile phone and having a laptop. No, I've got a laptop now, so I can't criticize it. It took 18 months for me to crack and get a laptop, but managing to live that long without phone, without constant contact is quite a challenge. The other big one, I didn't get onto this one earlier, is in China I was riding in the snow and it was getting down to about minus 12 at night, and I'd wake up, there'd be fresh snow on the tent. There's a couple of pictures up there, but I didn't get as many pictures as I should because I wasn't prepared for the snow and I just got too cold, and I got mild hypothermia at some point, so it wasn't as much fun as you'd think it might be.
Okay.
But this is a story I love telling. I always tell this one to kids because it always just makes them feel a bit sick when you tell them about it. On the back of the bike, there's the derailleur, which moves the gear up and down for non-technical people. There's the gears at the back, and there's a thing called a derailleur, which moves up and down, which shifts the gear, which makes it either harder to pedal or easier to pedal.
Right.
In China, I was coming along, there'd be maybe a couple of inches of snow on the ground, but the sun would come out each day and melt the snow. So you'd be going up these hills, going up, it was fine, but then you'd come downhill, the slush from the snow would fly up into the gears, and everything on that would freeze solid. So I couldn't change gears. And once you're at the bottom of a hill, you'd need to change gears to get back up the other side. So I was stuck in China in the snow, in the cold, and you need something warm to unfreeze the gears. So to cut a long story short, I was just urinating on my bike each day at the bottom of every hill. So it's something I quite enjoy, is finding a way to to overcome problems that you face.
Yeah, very, very original as well. Have you been in danger at all? You mentioned hypothermia there. I mean, did you have to sort of get treatment?
No, I just went to a... I was quite lucky in that the night that I got really, really too cold is the night before my sleeping bag had got wet and I hadn't had the opportunity to thaw it out and I was one more night away. And that was the night that I got symptoms of hypothermia and was just too cold. But I was quite lucky in the next day that not only did I find a town that I'd planned to stay in anyway, but this being China, I'd managed to find a town where I could have my own hotel room, private and a nice, like all the hot water I wanted, everything I needed for about £1.50 a night. So I stayed there for a couple of days, got everything dry, got everything sorted myself out, and then I was a couple more days in the snow and was out of it and was fine again. So in terms of danger, the biggest danger by a long way is cars. Is once you leave Europe, the way people drive is just horrendous, and I dread to think of the amount of near misses I've had. But at the same time, I've been hit three times. I've been hit by a motorbike, a car, and a lorry. But each time it's just been clipped or nothing too serious. So I've been.
And have they always kind of stopped to see if you're okay, or is that just not the thing?
The first guy didn't stop. The guy on the motorbike just took a look round, saw he'd hit me, and was like, "Oh dear, I'm not bothering to deal with this," and just drove off. The second guy I don't know if he would have stopped or not. I was quite lucky, but he didn't really have a choice. He started. He was in the center of a town, in the city center of a place in China. I think it was called Changsha or something like that. But he was reversing to give you an idea of how good the average driver is. This is not something that's unusual. But he was reversing backwards down a cycle path that had about 20 other cyclists on it, and just crashed into me. And because he was in a crowded city, he couldn't have not stopped. He didn't really have a choice. There was quite a big crowd gathering around to make sure
everything
was okay. So, but I'm not sure if he would have stopped. And the last guy was, he stopped as well. That was in Japan. And he was a lorry, and basically he turned out in front of me. He should have seen I was there, but it was one of those things that was just a genuine accident. He stopped and he gave me about £10 in Japanese money as compensation. He stopped his truck and gave me about £10.
Have you had any trouble with authorities at all, with police or visa people, anything like that?
No, see, this is the one thing that people always seem to ask, like, because this is something that seems to happen to other people, but it's never happened to me, everyone seems to have a story of how they've been arrested or how they've had problems with authorities. I've had two encounters with the police, both times. Basically, once my bicycle broke in China outside a police station, and from my experience, because they had the Olympics last year, all the Chinese police force had been forced to learn a bit of English, just like even if it's just the basics. So that was the only hope, because no one in China... I was in China for 3 months the first time round and met about five people that spoke English that weren't trying to sell me something.
Yeah.
So I went to the police station. I was quite lucky that the bike broke just outside the police station. And in China, because they've got so much state control, every little village... This village was maybe about 5,000 people, if that... Probably talking about 2,000 people at most. But it had each village like this has its own six-story police station, manned full-time with about 25 officers. And there's never going to be any crime there. So I went in there, and the guy who sat behind the counter, one of the first words he said to me was, "I'm so bored with my job," was the first English he had said to me. So that night, I was there with the police, and they said, "You're staying with us tonight." There was a bus to the next town to get the parts for the bicycle that I needed, but he said, "No, tonight you're staying with us. I need something to do." So I ended up staying there for the night, and I think they were pretty sad to see me go the next day. We had about 50 people showed up in this village to see the white guy in the rural Chinese town who was just riding his bike through. And the other time was in Thailand, was I was sat in a bus station. I failed to find somewhere to stay that night, and I think I'd sat in an internet cafe until quite late without meaning to and lost track of time. So I was going to go and sleep. I found like a little bus stop in the countryside. But the police had found me, and when they came up, there was about three police officers showed up, and I thought, "Oh God, I'm going to be in a bit of trouble here. They don't want me here." And the policeman said that he'd managed to find out, he'd got a translator or something like that, just to find the words "follow me." And I was like, "Oh God." So I had to follow on my bike, follow these two police cars, and then really worried about what was going to happen. And then he pulled up to his own front driveway, and he put up a mosquito net on his front porch, and he gave me a mattress and a duvet, and he let me sleep on his own, on the driveway of his house.
So. That's a fantastic story. That's that reaffirms your faith in humanity, that kind of
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, it's quite nice when you think you're just about to get arrested as well to find out you've actually got a meal waiting for you. And
excellent. What's the most sort of interesting or diverse place you've found yourself sleeping overnight? Have you had any problems at all finding places?
Well, when I first left England, I was really worried. One of the big things, actually, that I've taken out of this is how, as long as you're not in someone's way, you can sleep wherever you want in the world, in the entire world. It doesn't matter. As long as you're not in someone's way, even if it's illegal, no one cares as long as you're not in their way. So the first night, I remember when I camped in the wild in England, I was in it was like a little wood somewhere, and I was so paranoid the whole night. I had trouble sleeping, thinking that someone was going to come and kick me off at any time. And then I think by about Bulgaria, I was sleeping in parks. And then by the time it got to Kazakhstan, I was just not sleeping even with the tent. I was just putting off to the side of the road, laying out the ground sheet and just falling asleep on that. And I found that one of my favourite ways to sleep is just to fall asleep without underneath the stars. As long as it's dry enough and there's no mosquitoes, it's a great way to sleep. And then to say, like, finally, the most extreme was by the time I got to China, I was needing to get up. I was getting to the end of the China for the first time, I really wanted to just get out of the country, and I needed to be woken up each morning. But I'm not someone that finds it easy to wake up. So I was ending up sleeping in shop doorways, just because if you sleep in someone's shop doorway, when they come to work at 6 o'clock the next morning, they invariably just wake you up and kick you out. So it's quite a nice little alarm clock.
I can empathise with that. I like a good lion. Are there any regrets or anything you'd change about your route or what you've experienced?
I wouldn't say regrets, because I think it's all part of learning. There's things that if I was going to do this again, one of the things I probably, if I'd done a bit more research about it, was I would have taken a bit longer and got more visas for places such as Iran. I would have gone to Iran, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, but at the same time, failed to get those visas because I didn't leave enough time to plan for them, and they basically take a couple of weeks to sort them all out, and I don't have the patience to sit still for a couple of weeks. So I would have managed to sort out visas to go to those places. But at the same time, it's not something I regret, because it's been such a great trip as it is, and I'm still enjoying myself, and I can always go back there in the future.
So, can you believe that it's been 2 years? Does that just sound ridiculous to you?
It does. Well, when I left, I was 21, and I still feel like, when people ask me, I still feel like I'm 21, because it doesn't feel as though, like, what's actually happened. Like time, it doesn't feel as though time's moving at home whilst it is here. It doesn't feel like I'm pretty much on the verge of my third birthday on the road in a couple of months. What was I going to say? I was going somewhere with this. And the other thing that really puts off a sense of time is the lack of seasons that I've had. Because when I left, it was sort of spring coming into summer, and then I had a really long summer all the way up to about the end of October. I spent 3 weeks at the end of October in really harsh snow, and then came down the mountains in China after 3 weeks in the snow, which was pretty much the only winter I've had, came down into boiling hot, into Southeast Asia and right down into Cambodia, where it's the sweaty heat of 35 degrees each day in the middle of January. So you'd never really felt like winter at all. I had 3 weeks of cold weather and that was it. And then after that, the next cold weather I got was snow in when I was up in Alaska in August. So it was freezing up there. So I've had... Yeah, my seasons are all over the place. Then we came back to Mexico in January, and from early February onwards, it's been baking hot again, 25 degrees.
In terms of your all the equipment you've got, is the bike more or less the same as it was when you left? And have you found there anything you couldn't possibly have lived without? And is there anything you've had to sort of purchase on the way that you should have maybe had from the beginning?
The bike itself has been absolutely brilliant, I have to say. It's a Thorn Sherpa steel frame, and it's bomb-proof. It really has been. It's been hit by a car, a motorbike and a truck, and it's still perfect, still no problems. Can't recommend it highly enough. I've had to change quite a few of the components, obviously, just because of, when it's got nearly 25,000 miles on it, things need to get changed every now and then. And I think I'm onto the third set of tyres. So in terms of the bike, really couldn't be happy with it. The biggest problem I've had has been tents, and particularly tent doors, is that I've managed to get through a couple of tents now, and it's always the doors that break on them. So I'm kind of a bit worried that I'm headed into Central America and South America, which is snake country, and I'm sleeping in a tent that doesn't have a door, which is a bit of a worry right now. I'm not looking forward to that. So in terms of what I couldn't live without, The only thing I think I'd really struggle with is if I didn't have my parents on the end of the email, is they're the one thing that has kept me going when I've had really hard times. Is it's always nice to know that you've got like that secure background there, as I really couldn't be where I am without my mum and dad having been there every time I've needed something, every time I've needed someone to cheer me up or pick me up. I really couldn't have been there without them.
Have you got anything, any piece of equipment that is perhaps not necessary, that's a bit of a luxury, a kind of a home comfort?
That's a good question. Probably not, actually. I'm really down to the bare bones of what I've got. The only thing that that takes up space that would be nice to get rid of, but at the same time I think I really need right now, is the laptop. The only thing that takes up a bit of room, but at the same time that's what keeps me sane at the end of the day, so I really don't want to get rid of that. Good question. The only other problem I have is because I say you need books to keep you sane whilst you're travelling. And I stayed I stayed at a school in Guadalajara last month, and they said I could have free reign of their library and take any books that I wanted. And I got a bit crazy, and I'm now carrying 12 books, so which I really don't have room for. So I need to get some reading done and crack on with that.
need to buy a trailer.
Yeah.
Does it still represent a physical challenge for you?
No. I would say that it probably stopped, apart from like the really tough days, like I was saying, like when you're in the mountains and when you're up there in the hills and in the cold, it's pretty much stopped being a physical challenge in that now I can now ride 5 or 6 hours a day and not feel even remotely tired by what's happened.
Yeah.
So body's so used to what's going on and what I'm asking it to do with it that it's just, I think it's probably about 3 weeks it took me to get the necessary fitness, and I've not really struggled since then.
Do you have to sort of watch your diet to that? Are you taking more calories than you would do?
Yeah, there's actually a blog I wrote about this. I think it's the one that's about Canada somewhere. It's talking about like how basically for about a month up there, especially when there was no one around, because you're about 2,000 miles between cities or something like that. No, you're about 1,000 miles between each proper city up there. So it was basically becoming a machine each day. I was carrying about 10 days worth of food at a time, and just reading the contents of cans and things like that, making sure I had enough calories. And I did diet analysis. It turns out I was eating about 6,000 calories a day to just keep the body going.
Excellent stuff. And how is your body? Have you noticed sort of notable changes? Have you had any injuries? Is it holding up fine?
This is the question you didn't want to ask, because my friend... My friend who wanted to know. It's like, this is something that actually quite a few people ask about as well. It's just like your testicles and stuff like that. But they're fine. Before I left, in the January before I left, so we're talking 3 months before I left, I tore a ligament in my knee. I tore my meniscus.
Yeah.
So I wasn't walking. I wasn't walking very easily. I wasn't doing any exercise. And having an office job, I put on quite a bit of weight. So in the first 3 weeks, as I say, I lost 7 kilos, or I think that's about just over a stone in weight in the first 3 weeks of riding. And for those 3 weeks, I could feel me, especially the one that the engine was just coming back. I managed to get out on one ride before I left England.
Yeah.
And then as the knee wasn't strong enough to hold up to it. So the first 3 weeks, you could feel your knees changing shape. But after that, no, I have to say the body's felt pretty much constant throughout. The only other thing as well is, whilst I said about the testicles, which is the one people always ask about, is what people forget about is what the saddle does to your backside. In Korea, I was staying with two friends out there, and we go to the public baths out there. It's a great thing to do, is you go and you have your shower all together. It's going to sound a bit strange, but there's like 40 or 50 men all there showering at the same time.
Yeah.
Everyone's walking around naked. And then the two friends I was staying with pointed out to me that, completely unbeknown to me, is I now have a nice about 6-7 inch scar across my backside, from one side to the other, that's permanent from the saddle.
Really?
So I have a nice... It's kind of even in the shape of a saddle, too. I'm not going to post any pictures, but I think that's there to stay.
Excellent stuff. When you do get home... Well, before we go on to that, just tell us about what's left of your route. Where have you still got to go, and what are you expecting the highlights to be in the last couple of legs?
the last couple of legs is... Well, from here it's down to Argentina, to Ushuaia, or Tierra del Fuego, which is this small place right at the bottom of South America. So that'd be from the top of America right down to South America. I hope to arrive in Ushuaia around November or December this year, but I don't know. I think it's about 12,000 kilometres
from here, which should be doable fairly easily in the time, but there's always, as I found for the last year, there's always been distractions, there's always ways to get stopped riding a bike and plenty of things to keep you off, keep you in the same place for a while. So, but with a bit of luck, be there around November, December this year, and from there, making my way over to South Africa. I'm not quite sure how I'm going to do that yet. I've got a few contacts in the shipping industry for South Africa, so I'm hopefully, yeah, if I can work on something there, I'll hopefully manage to get over on a boat, but probably will get, at some point fly over. Yeah. And then from there, it's South Africa, up through the Middle East, back to Europe, probably be in Istanbul around Christmas 2011 and arrive home in early February 2012.
And are you, we talked earlier about home, but are you, despite not missing it, are you still sort of looking forward to being home eventually?
I don't know. I get the feeling that when I come home, I'm going to be home for 2 weeks, really enjoy it, do all the things I haven't done for ages, and then be sat there twiddling my thumbs, wishing I was somewhere else. I'd be surprised. I'd be surprised if I come home and don't move to Korea within 18 months of being home.
Really?
Yeah. I'll have to work for a while because, as I say, I managed to secure the extra £3,000 that I need to finish the ride, but at the same time, it's going to be debt. It's going to be... So I'm going to have to clear that debt by the time when I get home, and then once I've done that, I'd be very surprised if I don't head off to another country again. Korea, possibly Canada.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
Just tell us briefly as well about the charity that you're doing it for. How's the fundraising going, and what's it about again?
It's basically SOS Children's Villages, which is, it's the world's largest orphan charity, and we're building a village in Zambia, which is in South Africa, southern Africa. And the difference between why you should donate and the difference between these and the regular orphan charities is it's not just building an orphanage and a place to live. It's giving the kids a proper future. It builds an entire village. It builds a house for them. It builds a school, and it builds medical centres and builds counselling facilities to build communities in these places. And what also happens is that a local woman from a local area who can be anyone really, but it's a mother will come and live with the child, and one mother will look after 10 children until they turn the age of 18 and give them a proper family. So it's a really great way so that when that kid loses his parents, he'll go and live at the orphanage, at the village, sorry. And the mother who lives at that village, she'll leave her own house. She'll go and live at this house and look after these 10 children until they turn 18 and give them a real proper start in life.
Yeah.
So far we've raised £3,500, which is about 20% of the target, but I'd secretly like to raise a lot more. So if anyone out there is listening to it and wants to donate, please do.
Good stuff. Good stuff. So what about that charity that kind of attracted you to it in the first place? Why did you choose that one over?
I know a few people who have done some work with them before, and I had a look at their website, and it wasn't the most planned thing in the world. It was literally just a case of sending them an email saying, I'm doing this, I'd like to raise money for your charity. Is that okay? And they said, yep, we need money for this. And it took about a week to sort out. And they said, will you raise money for this? And I said, yes. So
there you go. Simple as that.
It's not a particularly interesting story, I'm afraid.
No worries. You may have already told it in the course of our conversation, but when you do get home and when you're in the pub with your mate for the first time in whatever, 3.5, 4 years, what would be the first story that you tell them? What so far is the absolute highlight for you?
Oh, God, I don't know. I really don't know. That's not a question I can answer. You're going to have to ask that one when I get back.
All right, I will do. Remind me. I think, Matt, that is probably more or less it, if you're happy with that. Have you got any plans to celebrate the actual date?
On the 29th, I will most probably be riding a bicycle, doing what I do pretty much every day.
Perfect way to celebrate.
I won't have any special celebrations. Last year, for the year anniversary, I had a nice meal and a couple of beers in China, but it was the same again on my own on the road. So I think that's probably where I'll be. That's where I'll be happiest.
Brilliant. Well, enjoy yourself and take care, obviously, and hopefully I will see you before too long.
Okay, thanks a lot, mate.
Good stuff. No worries. Cheers, Matt.
So there we have it. That was the first podcast, and a big thanks to Tom for taking the time to help out. As I say, there are more on the way, and whilst it was nice to answer a few questions, don't worry. The episodes coming up will feature my voice a lot less and focus a lot more on the other people of the world, the places you can go, and just generally with a lot more emphasis on something I'd recommend everyone listening to do, ride a bicycle. Before we go, I've obviously answered a few questions in this podcast, but if people out there have any more, please email them in. Lots of you have emailed in over the last couple of years, and the messages of support from strangers and answering your emails has really been one of the things that's kept me going, so please don't be afraid to get in contact. And also, as I said before, if anyone out there's got an interesting story that you think would be good on a future podcast, please, please, please email in. In the meantime, please continue to follow the ride on worldwidebikeride.com, and if anyone out there wants to donate to the charity and help to build the new SOS Children's Village in Zambia, you can donate online either through the website or www.justgiving.com/projectbike. Just to make this clear, all donations go straight to the charity and every penny is appreciated. But that's that. 2 years, 38,000 kilometres, and still really enjoying being on the road. Until the next podcast, I'm Matthew Blake, and thanks for listening. How could I forget to mention the bicycle is a good invention? Make it up, making you my business. A funny buttercup, gotta live a forgiveness. Happiness, but side of facing. Heaven knows I'm on the case. So how could I forget to mention the bicycle? Somebody told